Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic.
Hi, good morning. I'm Candace Jones. I'm the president and CEO of the Public Welfare Foundation and been working on youth and adult criminal justice work for my entire career. In a prior life, I ran the Illinois Department of Juvenile Justice, which is the youth prison system for Illinois, and worked a lot there to greatly reduce the number of youth in custody, a system that had 800 youth in facility when I was there and 1,200 youth that were under community supervision. On Friday, the governor of Illinois announced that they're going to close all the remaining youth prison facilities because now they have 100 youth in custody and just a couple hundred youth in community supervision, and try to start to reinvest some of that money in the communities that the youth come from, primarily a couple of zip codes in the state that are all Black communities. I thought Dwayne's book of poetry, you know, I'm usually not deep enough to be reveling in poetry on the weekend, but I thought it was really beautiful. And I think it's so important to have art and artists really translate the experiences that are happening in the American justice system in a way that practitioners and advocates will never be able to. So I'm thrilled to be here.
I'm Reginald Dwayne Betts. I'm a poet, and I write memoir as well. And I'm thrilled to be here also. I think part of my sort of relationship with this subject and the notion of young people being incarcerated comes from, you know, my own experiences. I went to prison when I was 16 and served a number of years, and I became a poet. I think back then I didn't understand why I made the decision as much as knowing that I was facing 8 years in prison, 9 years in prison, and I decided to be a writer mostly because I just figured if you wanted to survive prison, you had to survive by being something. And so I decided that that something for me would be a writer. I didn't know that, you know, so much of my writing would revolve around incarceration, would be me attempting to do the work of turning the horror, the suffering, the joy, the laughter, the experience into something that translates deeply into the bones of the reader or the listener. But I find that that's what I've been doing, or I've been attempting to do. And it's partly because so much of what we think about prison and people who are in prison, and what we think about young people who are in prison, is just deeply, deeply invested in the same types of cliches and stereotypes that allow us to have systems that incarcerate people.
I'm Richard Ross, and I'm an artist, activist, and I became involved in the juvenile justice system about 15 years ago when I was working on a project called Architecture of Authority. And I was shooting at a juvenile detention center, the architecture, and then I started talking to some of the kids who didn't speak English, and my Spanish wasn't that great. But I realized that in talking to them, I was their conduit. And I was their only voice, and I was their only shot at having somebody communicating to the rest of the world who they were and what they were about. And then that 15 years had me change my entire practice from trying to do something that was timeless to being something of my time. And my time is about mass incarceration and how we treat children in the system. And I look at people that work in this world, and some of them, like Dwayne and Candace, can do remarkable things, but art to me has to be a weapon that really engages other people and stops them and frightens them and seduces them to understand who these kids are. And my goal is to take all the data that great minds are able to produce, but the data exists in a really cold fluorescent light. And by putting these images and these voices and using first person, I hope that the data that's yearning for these anecdote and these real kids can come together and really build empathy and change policy. And it's just terrific to be able to work with the NGA, to be put together on this panel by Terrence Washington, who I want to give a shout out to, and be able to talk to Dwayne, whose work is so remarkable, and Candace, whose political action and what she's been able to accomplish is. These people are my heroes, and I'm just thrilled to be here today.
Thank you.
Dwayne, you were talking about becoming a poet allowed you to offer perspective that was different than the perspective that was out there about who ends up in custody. And Richard, you're talking about your work going in and taking these pictures and offering this new perspective. And that resonates with me so much in this moment in history because of the debate that's happening right now around monuments, you know, and these monuments, these historical monuments coming down. A friend of mine that I worked with when I was a White House fellow just wrote an op-ed in the New York Times and argued that monuments are the sacred monuments are those that memorialize veterans, U.S. veterans. And he was making this case that of all the things being argued is sacred ground, it's hallowed ground. And so it is therefore, you know, this indisputable fact that it can't be touched. And I couldn't help read his piece and think that the point that was being missed, that so much about it is perspective on who gets to decide. Who gets to decide what's sacred, right? In a country where it's like, I'm four grandparents, descendants of slaves, right? There's so many people in this country who sacrificed for this country, who have died for this country, frankly, their labor force, and there are not enough monuments and spaces that memorialize their sacrifice. And there are not enough arguments about how the ground that they toiled was sacred. So I think it's like, it's not about a compelling case. It's just about who gets to decide and whose perspectives. And your point, Dwayne, about being like, who gets to write the story of who's in custody, right? For the last three decades, the story of mass incarceration has been written by this, you know, public safety, law enforcement heavy, and that perspective told a very different tale than what I actually think is the truth of what was happening in those systems and in the community that people were being robbed from. And I think that's the same point you're making, Richard, which is very important in this society and in art and in storytelling to have a diversity of perspectives because the story comes out very different depending on who's telling it.
Yeah, but you know, I think the other thing that's interesting and that Richard was getting at in a way is that it's also who is seen in a story that's told. So we have a really limited bandwidth for how we choose to see people. And I think as a poet and as a memoirist, a lot of what I wanted to do is one of these arguments about not sending juveniles to prison. A lot of people say don't send juveniles to prison because you become a worse criminal. It's just criminal training school. Or don't send juveniles to prison because you'll be abused. And what that does is create a narrative about the men and women in prison that suggests that they only exist as predators. And so while we want to advocate for juveniles not to be in prison or for juveniles not to be in custody at all, we are doubling down on the notion that there are some who deserve to be there. And I think part of that, what it does is it erases so many people who exist in that system because of mass incarceration, who exist in a world that has never decided to grant them mercy. And we talk about monuments, right? Those monuments that are missing are monuments to what this country might do in a conversation that centers mercy, in a conversation that centers redemption, that centers restoration. And so when you see the image of this kid that's right behind Richard right now, I mean, that is like a dark, dark, dank, and harrowing place. And you realize that none of the narratives have ever actually in a substantive way situated that life in the center of it. And this is partly why I'm glad I'm a poet, even as I have gotten into policy work and have gone to law school and have represented clients. Because frankly, I've long felt that my insistence on being visible had to be made not just to people who were arguing for more incarceration, but also people who were my allies, who were arguing for less incarceration, because far too often, the sort of foundation of where they came from, of the foundation of where we come from, has been missing the art. And so it's interesting, because if you think about a monument as art, you realize that we have tied in some ways the idea of America to these monuments, but we have not done the same thing for the arguments against, you know, mass incarceration. We're only like beginning to do that in the past half a dozen years. And the fact that there are some nonfiction books that are amazing, that have completely transformed the way people think about the system, is beautiful. But what's really going to change and transform the way that the system actually exists and operates is that it's the jungle. It's Upton Sinclair, you know, it's like that great work of art that lays bare what the world actually really looks like. I think will be far more powerful than anything we've seen, you know, over the past 10, 15 years.
But I think that the audience is critical. And I think we have to get a certain people that aren't normally engaged, you have to get them engaged. And it's not just the privilege of the institutions of culture. And you have to figure out the strategy of who your audience is and how to reach them in a way that is not punitive, that isn't scolding them, that's not saying you should do this or you just do this, because there's complications involved in how you get people to feel comfortable with what you're messaging, either visually or verbally or politically. So we come from this from different worlds, from the arts, but my goal with creating this work is not to end up with a Pulitzer, not to end up with any accolades within the system, but to give this material to people like Candace that could use them as evidence. So she's the advocate. She knows how to use this material and who the audience is. And I think that some of my sympathy with what Duane does is the use of I, because I feel like when we're at our best, and I don't want to overstep my bounds by speaking for you, Duane, but when we use the I or first person singular, we're acting as the voices for these kids, for these people. And we do best when we step aside and let people into these rooms, let people hear these voices, because that's the way you're not threatened by them, but you realize that there's potential, that there's hope in every one of these voices, and there should be respect for who they are. The major strategic element that I use when I capture these images is knocking on the door of a cell, asking for permission to come in, taking off my shoes, and sitting on the floor of the cell so the kid is above me, and giving them that authority above me. But if you could be the person that's going to be knocking on other cultures' doors and asking for permission to enter those lives, and then just spending time giving somebody authority above you to tell their story, you can't help but be moved. And I feel a lot of Duane's poetry, while I try to understand what poetry is, my wife's a wonderful poet, but I'm not a native poet speaker. But then to wonder, he also gives me a clue as to what those experiences are. And it's always the I did this. But you realize that the experiences are so broad, it can't be just Duane. He's speaking for a host of people, and the way the words are constructed in such power and beauty, you can't help but pay attention to them.
I also think there's the point, just to build on that, about taking it to the masses, having it be accessible, but understanding that there is as much to be learned as to be given in that process. It's one of the reasons why mural art resonates with me so much. Like, I'm from Chicago, it's got a great mural arts culture. If you just walk down the street, you can be a part of these massive art installations, and you look up and you see this beautiful image of Muddy Waters, which reminds you that this is a place that has this rich history, and it's also a history that has been, you know, painted, used intentionally by Black people, by people from the South, by that perspective.
The thing I find interesting and troubling is that our institutions of incarceration exist without art.
Yeah.
And you find people really struggling to infuse their lives with art, whether it's, I never decorated my cell wall. I just didn't do it. But I think that's the way that people seek to infuse their world with art. And I think that's like a powerful way that people seek to do it. And I think now part of the things I work on, I turn, you know, you said, who is it that you take the art to? And for me, you know, part of the who is also people who are incarcerated. And I've turned Felon into a solo show. And the reason why I turned Felon into a solo show is because the book is a beautiful thing, but the book is also something that creates a bit of distance between you and the audience. And it feels different when you stand up in front of somebody and just, they're looking at you and then you say, name a song that tells a man what to expect after prison. Explains Occam's razor. You're still a suspect after prison. And it changes for me the way I communicate the poem, but it also changes, I think, how the medium operates in somebody's life, because it's no longer, it taps into some old tradition. And you know, one of the things I'm trying to do now is bring that into these institutions so that people inside recognize that the same way in which we demand art to be the substance of change, it's also what I think we demand on the inside, to just think about it in the whole landscape of the human experience. And so, you know, maybe you are Muddy Waters coming out of poverty, mastering an instrument that a kid right now will only believe they can learn with lessons. Like, imagine that. The penny harp, something you could fit in your pocket. Muddy Waters, these cats turned it into gold and they taught themselves. And we live in a world in which art is always, and I guess this is part of what Richard was saying, it's always mediated by who has access and opportunity. And so I think, you know, part of the thing I want to do is challenge that, is challenge, what do we mean by access and opportunity? And in doing that, challenge, like, what do we mean by the audience? Because when I know my work by heart, right, my audience is a decision that I make every moment of the day. And that one is just sort of scripted based on, like you know, you tell your family you're a poet, they'd be like, oh, say something. And you're like, I don't have my book with me. I'm sorry. It's like, what do you mean you don't have your book with you, you know? And so I'm trying to take it back to that, thinking, though, that when I give it to Candace, or when an advocate or a politician uses my work, the reason why they could use it, I hope, is because it's true. You know, and it is threading all of these stories, and it's not easy stories. You know, the truth I try to push in my work demands that we think about domestic violence and account for it, demands that we think about trauma and account for it. And in doing that, I hope that I'm imagining creating a system that's created with all of the challenges. You know, not creating a system because I'm telling you that those incarcerated are sort of flawless. It's like, nah, with all of the scars and all of the flaws and all of the trauma, we need to do something other than put people in cages. And I hope my poems say that, you know?
And I think it's so interesting that you say, not only do we not take art into institutions, we don't just not take art into institutions, but we penalize it. Because I remember in Illinois, you know, if you painted or drew on the wall, not only could you be penalized, like, we could charge you with criminal damage. Like, we say to people while they're reacting to their experience in this really human way, I want to be able to surround myself with things that make this feel humanizing. I want to bring and infuse art into this space. We literally, not only do we not allow it, but we penalize it. We say that any, that sort of human yearning, that human sort of need, we say that not only can't you do it, but we can hold you accountable to it because it's destruction of state property. And it's in contrast to the way it's done in other places. When I was, you know, I went abroad and we went to this prison in Norway where you walk through there, they have grounds and they have spaces that are humane and a real understanding. And they said to us, they were like, we are here to treat people like humans because as we return to society, like that's what we all need. And we don't do that in this country.
So again, that goes to the role of art in different places, but within the community, I think part of this conversation originally started with Candace and the NGA with the idea of having the NGA maybe helping host an exhibition of this work in that institution on U Street. And I just thought at some point, you have to have social welfare as the art institution itself, as the branch of the NGA, and really have satellites within the community and talk to the community what they want to have there. And this is endemic with a lot of institutions that have a focus of almost colonial or patronizing of, we know what's best for you, or okay, well, we're going to have a show of this person because it seems to represent what we think would be representative of this community, instead of really having a logical place at the table and a position of real power. But that's changing because we are all in the middle of a pandemic, which may give an opportunity for real change that may last, maybe.
So I started recently, I got some funding to start a project. It's called the Million Book Project. And the intention of the organization is to build what I call literary time capsules. You know, when we were younger, we would build time capsules, put all of these objects in canisters so that people in the future would understand how we lived and who we were. Well, I feel like part of incarceration is to almost put your body on ice and strip you of the ability to fully understand who you are. So you come home and it's a bit of confusion and re-entering the world. And I fully believe that books are the thing that allows you to stay in touch with who you are, to stay in touch with who you might want to be, and particularly when you're incarcerated, to reveal worlds and worlds to you. And so the Time Capsule I'm building is a curated collection of 500 books, and I'll be installing this in prisons across the country and in Puerto Rico. And the thing is, and this is what I fundamentally believe to be true, is, you know, we think about the way that we want to do the work on the inside and the outside. And the work is always to make the prison exist as a space that demands that it doesn't exist. And so if the prison is filled with bars, with handcuffs, with degradation, we expect it to exist because of what it's filled with. When it's filled with art, when it's filled with animals, when it's filled with the way in which we live our lives, and all of those things get juxtaposed with the bars and the cages and the violence, then all of a sudden you realize that both can't exist in the same space.
One of the things, the point Richard was making is the Public Welfare Foundation owns the True Reformer Building, which is a building here that was built at the turn of the century by Black people. And it was here to offer services to emancipated people who were fleeing the South and pooling right down the street from the building in Washington, D.C. They pooled their resources, had the Black architect, Black subs, everybody build this building and offer loans and services that those people couldn't get on the market. And a couple of years ago, we took on this project just to say, and the building's on the historic registry, but I think people will walk past here every day in a community that's ever changing and have no idea about the incredible history that's sitting right in the middle of this DC neighborhood. And so we got a mural artist, like someone, a young Black man from DC, lived his whole life here. We just told him what we were trying to do it, of course, because again, I'm not an artist. And he went off and did these massive story murals on the building, which tell the history. And part of what it was just to remind us every day that we're walking in here, that we stand on sacred ground, because I think it reinforces the overall mission of the work. We have work from Art 180, which is an art project down in Virginia of youth who've been system involved, who get to tell their own story. And they take their story, both visual art, but also they do narrative work and they take it down and do policy. And these youth, I mean, they're kids and they have beautiful perspectives, and we put that up. And so I told Richard, in the most ineloquent way, I would myself get some blue painter's tape and tape his very precious photos into the window former building. And I'm not making it, you know, I'm no gallerist, right? Like I told him, some of them, one of them might not be perfectly hung, but I think it's so important to reflect back to this community, the history of this place, and have people be able to see themselves as a part of that storytelling, as a part of that sharing of art. Because I, you know, it just reminds us sort of who gets the power to decide. And while sort of, I think being having the privilege to be the steward of this institution, I want to make sure that that story is told, that it's something that's left behind.
And I should say, actually, you know, the Million Book Project exists because Elizabeth Alexander is the president of Mellon. And you're right, you know, it's so much about who is the person that is able to usher things into existence, but also who is the face of institutions and organizations to help transform the way we think about what's needed. I think one thing that's cool about Richard's work, and actually this notion of juxtaposing his work with that of young people who are doing similar things, is I knew his work before I knew who he was. And I knew his work before I knew who he was because so many of the organizations that I respect who have been doing work on the ground used, to your point earlier, used your work and used those images in the work that they were doing. And I think maybe that's part of the point too, is to figure out and to think seriously about creating more partnerships in that way between the advocacy organizations and the art. And I gotta say that I always thought about those images as existing both as art and as vehicles for understanding. And I'm trying to think about how to grapple with us as multitudes and love us even when the version of ourselves that we present to the world doesn't really demand that we be loved. You know, and I think that's the hard part about young folks and dealing with, you know, these issues, is that we are so willing not to love people who steal a car, you know.
Well, you are brilliant and loving and wonderful, as are many of the kids that we end up encountering. And when you write things like the relentless abundance of days, man, does that phrase resonate today for everybody when we have so much time and trying to figure out how we use it. But I also, one point I wanted to make was the institution. We're here under the umbrella of the National Gallery of Art, who very often have been used to looking at work as the artifact. It has to exist as tangible, and it has to be work like this has to be matted, framed, crated. The registrar has to inspect any dog-eared corners and make sure there's the proper condition report. And when I talked to Candace about, I'll send you whatever you want, put it up in the window so that it faces out, use blue painter's tape, and she's saying, I can do that? What happens if I screw one up? I said, it really doesn't matter. It's not about what the image is inherently, it's about what it does for the people that are going to engage it. And I think that poetry, when Duane starts talking about having an exhibition of the work, I really think the power of the words is when you feel them on your tongue and it bounces around in your brain and you feel the cells are so much like middle crossing, and how you make all these visual images, verbal, come together in a stew that changes your life so dramatically.
People would tell me a few things when I started out doing this. They would say, one, don't mention a crime that you got convicted of. Pivot. It's like, pivot to what? A lie? Like, no, I carjacked somebody and we need to deal with that, right? And people would tell me, don't mention a crime you got convicted of. And then it will always be a framing that looked to juxtapose the worst of what young people dealt with in prison as a means of arguing against the existence of juvenile transfer to adult court. And I think that we could argue against the existence of juvenile transfer to adult court, even if everybody who got transferred would meet a mentor. they still shouldn't go to prison. And to your point, we can't get a mentor for all 2 million people, but I do think that it's a framing that we could begin to develop that suggests the way in which people inside are mentors to each other. So I come home and I apply for a job, and the poetry that I published in prison isn't legitimate as evidence of a skill set. When I come home and I apply for college, the poems I published in prison aren't evidence of a legitimate skill set. The work that I did while incarcerated isn't evidence of a legitimate skill set. The art I produced, the programs I led, like none of that is a body of work that we could lean on as a part of the whole scope and spectrum of my life. And I think, you know, part of this discussion, at least around art, is really thinking of how artists are born and trained and nurtured, even if inadequately, you know, behind bars, and how they do the same thing for others. Because, you know, even if we say we're going to end incarceration, unless it happens overnight, it's going to be some years. And during those years, we need to figure out how to acknowledge the work that folks have done. My homeboy just got out, 24 years in prison, and he was actually innocent, and he got a conditional pardon. But he did 24 years. It's very little that he did over that 24 years that any employee would give credence to. You know, and it's like, how do we create a world and a system in which we begin to think about that work that's being done on the inside being relevant to the lives that get built on the outside, recognizing that for the people who come home, who succeed, who do well, that time is never dead time. They have to find ways to make that time a part of who they'll become.
The Vera Institute of Justice, which is led by Nick Turner, that institution has really turned in its 60, 70 year history to be more explicit about racial justice and the kind of reform that it's a part of in the world. And they're doing this national project called Restoring Promise, where they're going into prisons. They're, you know, working with folks who are establishing these mentoring programs. And the mentoring programs are people in custody mentoring people in custody, and not saying that that talent needs to be found out in the world. It's recognizing that it's there. There's a shared experience. There's a maturity of experience there. And so I think there are models that are trying, but I don't think that the level of investment in those models is nearly comparable to what we've put into bricks and mortar prison. And I also think that there, it's not an accident that access to information, access to storytelling is minimal. I think one of the reasons that those systems exist the way they have for so long is because the access to information is so separate. I don't think it's an accident that most prisons are off in some far-flung jurisdiction in states. The idea that you could separate people from the reality of what happens, what we pay for, I think is something that we do intentionally. And so I do think that the work of storytelling and transparency and visibility into what goes on behind those walls is so important. But I think there have been real efforts to minimize that access before, because it allows the rest of us to continue to sleep, eat, and drink without having to fully appreciate what we're doing in this society to human beings.
Well, Candace, you mentioned different states and different cities, and we don't have any federal policy. It's a given that all these, every issue we're dealing with is a state issue, and it's so hard to coordinate as an artist in terms of how you can have impact from state to state or jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So I depend on you. I depend on people like Liz Ryan, James Dald, a million different people, but I don't have the access. I live in relative isolation. But that doesn't mean there can't be national policy that acts as a model. So when Obama said, we're going to eliminate isolation for juveniles in custody, in federal custody, everybody applauded. But I think it impacted about 26 kids, which were mostly DC or Native American kids. But it was a moral compass as to what we could be doing. When Dwayne talks about different programs that could be created within these institutions, I really wonder about incorporating the JCOs or the COs as part of it. Because I think what you have is a flattening of society with a lot of urban Black men and women of color being held in institutions, as Candace said, really out of the way by white, many of them white, rural corrections officers that aren't getting paid that much. But if you have everybody taking a poetry workshop together and everybody was involved together and feeling like everybody could work without losing respect for who's incarcerated and who's supposed to be guarding them, but you might have a moment or a way to engage in a way that is really humane.
I think it's important, as you're saying, to find ways to flatten that sort of us versus them mentality. And one way is acknowledging how the notion that we come from different communities isn't even as true as we always suggest. And it's never clear to what degree it is true. But the other point that I would make is you do have projects where people are trying to find ways to create, I was interviewing COs about COVID, and I can't remember the exact word that she said, but in a place like Virginia, the guards are now encouraged to have more communication with the men and women incarcerated because it's supposed to be a healing environment. And again, this is just like baby steps, right? But they are trying to change the rhetoric and try to change some of the relationships.
And I think that part of everything we approach with trying to change the system is we do have to think it's overwhelming. And there are days that you wake up that are, I feel despondent, not necessarily depressed, but overwhelmed by all the shit going on. When you're incarcerated, it's beyond, it's multitudes of pain and isolation that we just start to touch on as a society, but these people live it for decades. But it's, how do you change that? Well, you have to think little by little and step by step, and then you have to think with a plural pronoun. We can do anything. The stories are singular. I am this person, this is who I am. But when it comes to moving forward, I think it has to be we. And I think that the arts are an important part of that one.
I agree with you. I think the point, if the National Gallery of Arts doesn't control every local museum, but if they start engaging in conversations about race, about justice reform, I do think that that will model for other institutions that there's a new standard in how you show up as a traditional art institution and what's happening in society right now, right? If art is part about being artifacts, then you're collecting artifacts of what's happening that the world that you exist in. And this is a part of this world that we all live in. So hopefully art institutions are collecting artifacts to be able to tell that story to future generations in a way that offers more perspective, is broader and honest than some of the storytelling about these issues that we've seen in the past. And so I agree with you. It really is a collective we. We all have our water to carry. But I think traditional institutions, the federal level, and particularly art, has an incredible role to play in making this more accessible to the world that we live in now, but frankly, also in leading, you know, leaving a more artist, honest set of artifacts to future generations about what happened.
I say, Lucille Clifton has a new book coming out on BOA Editions. And it's called How to Carry Water. And I think that, you know, that is a lesson for all of us, right? It's not how I carry water. It is how to carry water. And within those poems, within that book, I know the poems will be given a sort of a lesson for everybody. And I think at the best of it, that's what art does. You know, I think that once we learn to read art as a community artifact, then we recognize that the work is always teaching us something. And I would say that they had an exhibition of Titus Kaphar's work. And so just to bring us full circle, when we started this conversation talking about monuments, you know, his work took some of these iconic paintings, these iconic pieces about presidents, about the founding fathers of this country, and it didn't necessarily strip the art. It didn't destroy the art. What it did is it complicated the story. It added pieces of the story that don't frequently get told publicly. When we think about incarceration, we have been willing to tell the Horton story, right? We've been willing to tell certain kinds of stories that stigmatize and that exacerbate the more punitive aspects of who we want to be. And now the question is, how do we open up art in a way that, you know, Rich's work does, in a way that my work does, open up that art to tell more expansive stories so that when we tap into it, you know, for the collective, we are tapping into something that isn't ashamed and afraid to deal with the struggles that we face, to deal with the challenges, and we can deal with those and build a new system. And so I'm grateful for this conversation, period, you know, because I think this conversation is also just reflective of what institutions can do, which is bring voices together in communication in ways that they might not have been otherwise. And so this has been a really cool, thoughtful conversation. And I look forward to, actually it's a challenge, because it's what work will we build in collaboration together, you know, even if it's just one moment, so that we're making sure that we're instituting the opportunity for some artifacts to be collected and assembled and live and breathe in a moment.
One thing we always have to do if we're getting near the end of anything is ask the poet to come to a point where he reads one of a section or one of his poems.
So this is looping back around, because I was like, a real poet, you know, you ask him to say something, he ain't got to be like, oh, I don't have my book with me. So I got something. I'm going to read Blood History. The things that abandon you get remembered different. As precise as the English language can be, with words like penultimate and perseverate, there is not an exact combination of sounds that describe only that leaving. Once, drinking and smoking with buddies, Fats asked if I longed for a father. Had he said wanted, I would have dismissed him in a way that youngins dismiss it all. Shrug, sarcasm, a sharp jab to the stomach, laughter. But he said longing, and in a different place, I might have wept. Said once, my father lived with me, and then he didn't. And it fucked me up so bad that I didn't think about his leaving until I held my first son in my arms, and only now speak on it. Once, a man who drank Wild Irish Rose and whiskey like water said, there is no word for father where he comes from. Not like we know it. There, the word father is the same as the word for listen. The blunts we passed around let us abandon our tongues. Not that much, though. But what if the old head knew something? And if you have no father, you can't hear straight. Years later, Fats wondered why I didn't name my son after my own father, as if he ain't know. Some things turn your life into a prayer. The gods will certainly, certainly answer.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.